Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast zooming in on the world's political, security and social shifts through the lens of its media.
A complete lack of control of the state and the government.
Conflicting narratives.
They're feeling the impact of this war.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service.
This is a story from 1980s El Salvador. Of children caught in the middle of fighting between government soldiers and left-wing rebels.
The door opened and there was a soldier there with a big rifle and he didn't say anything, he just shot me.
It's a story of families torn apart in the nightmare of civil war.
My mom used to say, the child is still alive. I can feel it. I have to find him.
And a story of children growing up with broken identities.
I was like a ghost.
A ghost?
Yeah. At this time I was lost.
I'm Mike Lanchin, and I used to report from El Salvador for the BBC. Now I'm going back there on the trail of answers to decades-old questions about the children who went missing during the country's 12 years of civil war. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. This is part one of El Salvador's missing children. I've been wanting to tell this story for many years, ever since I lived and worked in El Salvador after the end of its civil war in the 1990s. But I'm not going to begin in that tiny Central American nation, sandwiched between Honduras and Guatemala, but many thousands of kilometres away, in rural France. You can't get more French than this, preparing the batter for a very French dessert.
Do you like making crepe?
Yes.
And the children like it, I bet.
Oh, yes.
Jasmine is making crepes for her husband and three children, two girls and a little boy. They're waiting excitedly at the large wooden dining table next door. Jasmine has a round, friendly face with high cheekbones, accentuated by her smile. She's 42 years old and has spent nearly all her life in France. But she was born in El Salvador. You can immediately spot she's Salvadorian. Her light skin colour reminds me of the people from the region where my own wife is from. Jasmine came to France in the early years of the Salvadorian Civil War, when Marxist guerrillas were fighting to overthrow a US-backed government. El Salvador was on the front line of the Cold War between the West and the communist Soviet Union. Thousands of civilians were forced to flee.
I was adopted when I was 2.5 by French parents in August 1984.
And what's the name you were given when you came to France?
Aurélie. Aurélie, Marie, Madeleine, Pic.
And your birth name is different?
Yes, Jasmine, Esmeralda, Vanegas, Mejia.
The French family who adopted Jasmine also took in another child, a little boy, not related to her, but also from El Salvador. Jasmine seems very settled in her home in this corner of southwest France, with its large open fields and a garden where she can let her dogs run free. But that's not how she feels inside.
generally, when you were a little girl living with your parents and your little brother, were you a happy child?
With everybody, but not with my parents, because they didn't give me love.
So you were happy at school with your friends?
Yes.
But just not with your parents?
Exactly. I felt like a stranger in the house, and I don't know how to explain that, but something missing. There is something like a wall.
At school, Jasmine made up stories about herself. She knew she was from El Salvador, but when she asked her parents for more information about her adoption or where she came from, she didn't get far.
They said, you come from Salvador, you have no parents there, and we have no information. We can't have children, and we had adopt. That's all.
What did you think about that?
So when they told me this, I was like a... comme on dit déjà, un fantôme, a ghost.
A ghost?
Yeah. At this time, I was lost, maybe.
One day, when Jasmine was still a teenager, her French uncle took her aside and told her that he knew her real name, her birth name, and that he'd seen it on her Salvadorian adoption papers. He said not to tell her parents that he'd spoken to her.
He said that my name was Jasmine Esmeralda Vanegas Mejia, and I was very happy at this moment. It's like I became a somebody. Je devenais moi, en fait.
You became you.
Yes.
You can hear just how delighted Jasmine was to know her birth name. Later, she began using it instead of her adopted French name, Aurélie. But why didn't her parents want to tell her more? Maybe they had something to hide, she thought, or were ashamed that they couldn't have children of their own. I asked Jasmine if I can speak with her adoptive parents, but she tells me they're elderly and wouldn't want to talk, and that relations are strained. On her brother's 21st birthday, her parents suddenly presented them both with their Salvadorian adoption papers.
And so it says, the adoption of a child... La Menor, the child, Jasmine Esmeralda Banegas Mejia, and the name of the... And then there's a date on it, isn't there?
Though she already knew her birth name from her uncle, it was the first time that Jasmine was seeing her mother's name.
So there's a signature at the end. Antonia Mejia Oriana, 24 years old. Seeing your mother's name on the papers must have been something else.
I said, wow, okay. In my head, I thought, now you have all informations for searching your biologic parents.
C'est très joli, qu'est-ce que c'est?
Des Congo.
But the demands of bringing up a young family meant that Jasmine's search had to be put off for many years, and it wasn't until just 18 months ago that she finally took the plunge and sat down at her computer at home.
And I wrote missing children in Salvador, something like that, and I have a link, Pro Busqueda, Association Pro Busqueda.
Asociación Pro Búsqueda, the Association in Search of Missing Children, a Salvadorian non-governmental organisation that since the end of the Civil War has been searching for and reuniting families torn apart by the conflict.
And I sent a message by Facebook. They replied the day after, very quickly. I was very surprised. And they proposed me to send my story by email.
It is very peaceful here.
Yeah.
So this is a little vegetable garden, but it's, yeah, in the winter,
little.
It's nothing.
You have 1, 2, 3, 4,
tomatoes and cucumbers.
Probuska asked Jasmine to send them her adoption papers and any photos she had, and to do a DNA test. It's the start of a long process, Jasmine's told, but one that might just bring some comfort or at least some information about what occurred during her adoption. And maybe, just maybe, some clues about a surviving relative back home.
I cross fingers for an answer. Maybe my mother, maybe my father, together, or some uncle, some sister, brothers. So I'm wait for good news.
Jasmine, do you have an image of what you think your mother and father were like? Do you have any sort of image in your subconscious?
Not at all. Not at all.
Can you imagine?
No. I can't. Too difficult. I can't. And I prefer not to imagine. Because if I have the chance of find my mother or my father later, I don't want to be disappointed. That's why I don't want to imagine
anything.
No. No.
Jasmine's story raises many vital questions about identity and belonging and reconciling the past. Questions that I heard from other Salvadorians when I was reporting there for the BBC in the 1990s. That was a time when people were desperately trying to put back together the pieces of their broken lives after 12 years of fighting. I'm hoping that it's back in El Salvador where I might be able to understand better what may have happened in Jasmine's case. These noisy streets of the sprawling Salvadoran capital couldn't be further away from the quiet of rural France where Jasmine and her family live. I've come now to a rather nondescript building on a busy main road in the city, to the offices of the Probuscada Association. There's no sign here on the heavy metal door. I'm told that they like to keep a low profile since not everyone agrees with what they do, raking up painful stories from the past. It's much cooler inside. There's a hum of quiet conversation. Everyone seems to be hard at work. The offices are full of posters with children's faces beside the letters "Donde están?" Where are they? And photographs on the walls of happy family reunions.
Mi nombre es Margarita Zamora. Soy incluso originaria.
This is Margarita Zamora. She's the lead investigator for Probuscada and has been with the group for more than 20 years. She says that during the war, civilians who lived in areas under rebel control were immediately seen by the army as rebel supporters. Children, she says, were often targeted in order to terrorize the population.
Many of the children who were taken from the battlefield were given away in adoption. Many appeared as if their parents had given their consent, but the parents were in fact killed. There was no consent given.
She says that members of her own family are among those missing after a massive army sweep of the countryside at the very start of the war.
Se da la separación el momento del operativo, un momento que el.
My mother and father were separated when the army surrounded them. My mom ran off one way with three of the children. My dad was with the other child, but he lost her in the confusion. We think my mom was killed, but we have no idea what happened to my brothers and sisters. Despite our investigations, we still don't know.
So far, Probuscada has located more than 400 children separated from their families during the war. Not all ended up being adopted, but Margarita says there are still some 500 unresolved cases, among them her siblings, and perhaps also Jasmine in France. You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. This is El Salvador's Missing Children, with me, Mike Lanchin. Leaving Margarita and Probuscada for now, I head across town to meet two elderly sisters, whose lives have been marked by just such a story.
Hola.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Bien, yo soy Mike. Hola.
Mucho gusto, hola. Mike.
Qué bueno verlo. Qué bonita la casa.
Ah, gracias.
Qué bonita plantas, tiene. Lovely plants you've got here.
Dalila lives in a neat, well-kept house in a residential neighbourhood with bougainvillea in the patio and decorative art on the walls. Her sister, Aide, lives nearby. They're two of eight siblings. Dalila is the second, Aide the fourth. Their youngest sister was called Ana Milagro, or Mila. We sit down together on the sofa to chat about her. She was a quiet one, Aide tells me, a sadness gathering on the lines of her face. Dalila, slim and grey-haired like her sister, joins in. Mila kept herself to herself, she says. I feel I didn't really know her. She used to tell our mum that she was going out to karate classes, Aide laughs. I don't think she ever learnt much of that. That was in the early 1980s. Rising popular protests were being met by repression, and many young students like Mila were secretly joining the Marxist guerrillas. It was very dangerous, and Mila lived a double life. Her boyfriend, Luis, was also part of the rebel network in the city.
They never ever told us what they were involved in. But we were always afraid. Soldiers would patrol the streets and raid the houses. Luis and Mila got married and announced they were going to Guatemala. They disappeared for about a year and then they came back. But I don't think they had ever left the country.
In 1981, Luis and Mila had a baby boy, her third child. They called him Roberto. By then, the war was in full swing. Mila was living with Aide in her flat, and their mother had fled to safety in Costa Rica with Mila's two other children. One day, Mila said that she was going to join her mother. Suspecting perhaps that she might be going off on another mission with the rebels, Aide begged her to leave the baby behind in her care.
Y le decía yo. Porque el niño estaba de meses. Déjame el niño, le decía.
I told her, leave me the baby. He was just months old. I told Mila, leave him with me. Why are you taking him to? But she said, no, I can't. And so she went away with him.
Mila and baby Roberto never made it to Costa Rica. They ended up in Honduras instead, where Mila was tasked with looking after a guerrilla safe house. The family heard nothing for months, until the briefest of phone calls. Dalila says that another of their sisters answered the phone.
Que en la voz de ella, de Mila, se notaba que algo le preocupaba.
She said that you could tell by her voice that Mila was worried and very sad. She said that Mila asked after her other children and said, please, look after them. It was as if she knew what was going to happen to her.
And that was the last they heard from Mila. Months later, someone sent word that she was dead. The family later found out that she'd been killed in a police raid on the rebel safe house. But no mention was made of what had happened to baby Roberto. It wasn't until more than a decade later, in 1993, after the end of the Civil War, that with the help of Probúsqueda, Dalila, Aide and their mother were able to set about searching for Mila's missing son.
Ella era, mi mami era una mujer fuerte.
Our mom was very strong. She kept her emotions to herself. She would cry when she was alone, but you could see the sadness in her face. She used to say to us, I'm sure he's alive. I can feel the baby's alive. I have to find him.
The women's determination paid off.
Whoops, we should be recording. Okay, so thank you for joining me. So, Nelson, Roberto, should I be calling you Roberto or should I be calling you Nelson, do you think?
I go by both. Now I use it, the Nelson Roberto,
as sort of an homage to, you know, that there is this other side of me that existed before I was named Nelson. So, you know, most of the time I just go by Nelson, though.
I speak to Nelson, or Roberto, as his family in El Salvador knows him, on the line from Boston, where he's been living since being adopted by an American family who travelled to Honduras in the 1980s and were told that a two-year-old toddler needed a loving family, but little else about where he'd come from or who he really was.
So growing up, it was me, my adopted parents, and my younger brother, Derek, and my memory of it is we were sort of a happy family. You know, we went to Red Sox games and summer camp and had a lot of happy memories.
Did you feel you fitted in?
Growing up, I always knew that I was adopted. It was very apparent. I'm Latino and my adoptive family is white. And I could see from a very early age that I was different, but my adoptive parents were also very open and honest with me.
Nelson had a happier childhood than Jasmine in France. His parents told him the little they knew of his family background. But still, he had the same feeling of something missing.
There's this moment that I remember very clearly when we're on vacation in Florida, and I look up and I see that my younger brother, I can see the family resemblance between him and my adoptive parents. And it was just a sort of like fleeting thought of, where are the people who look like me?
They were in El Salvador looking for him. But Nelson or Roberto couldn't know that. Not until one day when he was 16. He'd just got home from summer camp and was greeted by his adoptive parents, Tom and Margaret, saying, "We need to talk to you."
My parents sat us down at the dinner table, and my adoptive father places this newsletter in front of me. And he points to the man on the front cover and he says, "This is Dr. Robert Kirshner, and he does human rights investigative work in El Salvador." And I sort of knew at that moment that we were going to talk about my adoption. And I also sort of knew that, like, this was it. We had found my family.
Or rather, his family had found him. Together with Honduran human rights groups, Pro Búsqueda had painstakingly pieced together the circumstances around his mother Mila's death. And they'd found a paper trail that showed how, after a year in an orphanage, Roberto had been adopted by an American couple. He was asked to do a DNA test.
As soon as the results came back positive, we booked the tickets, and a couple months later, we were walking out of the airport and meeting my family for the first time.
¿Quiénes son ahí?
Ahí estamos toda la familia.
So she's showing me a photograph of all the family there.
Aquí está Roberto, aquí está Margaret, y aquí está Margaret Thomas, aquí estoy yo.
The adoptive parents, and there's you standing next to Thomas. Which one is Roberto, the boy in the middle? He was 16 by then, wasn't he? 16 años, didn't he? Sí.
It was December 1997. Dalila, his aunt, remembers it well.
The moment I saw him, I knew it was him. He looked just like his brother. He came forward and hugged everyone.
More than 30 members of Nelson's family were waiting for him, including his grandmother and his father, Luis.
I saw this man emerge from the crowd. And he looked just like me, or he looked like how I would look like when I got older. And it was my biological father.
Aide smiles at the memory of that happy day.
Le cambió la cara, bien feliz.
Our mother's face changed immediately. She was overjoyed. "I knew my grandson was alive," she said. "Thank God."
Gracias a Dios, decía.
Nelson's adoptive mother, Margaret, was looking on with her husband, Tom, and son, Derek.
It was kind of overwhelming. It was kind of a miracle. It was a miracle. It was wonderful. Later on, I was upset. But at that moment, it was just a tremendous emotion. We were kind of standing on the side a little bit, Derek and Tom and I, and watching all of them embrace. we didn't really know how it would all play out, but you kind of have some faith.
This was one of Probuscida's successes, a missing child found, a family brought back together, a happy ending. They all still keep in regular contact and visit each other. Nelson's even making a film about it all. But many others are still waiting, just like Jasmine in France, waiting for investigators to make a similar breakthrough. No one knows how many other children from El Salvador are out there, adopted into foreign families, but counted as missing by relatives back home.
Hey. I was preparing my next movie.
This is Flor de Luz, here playing board games at home in New York with her two children, a son aged 21 and her 14-year-old daughter.
No. It has to be coming from a gem.
It says whatever that word.
Beneath this happy family scene lie many of those same uncertainties that Jasmine and Nelson have lived with. Who am I? Where do I come from? Why was I not told more? Flor was just 5 years old when soldiers came to her village in El Salvador, and she was separated from her birth family. She was adopted by an American couple. It was at the height of the Civil War.
Honestly, I just want to know what happened. I just want to know why I wasn't with my biological parents. Why was I separated? What happened from that moment?
Now in her 40s, Flor has been left wondering what lies behind her half-remembered childhood traumas.
There was a time that my mother told me that when I was in kindergarten in the United States, she got a phone call to come to the school because there was an incident where I had all the children lined up in a firing squad, and I was standing in front of them shooting all of them.
You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service with me, Mike Lanchin. Next time in the second part of El Salvador's Missing Children, we hear more of Flor's story and follow her search for answers. And we'll be back with Jasmine as she continues to try to find out what lay behind her separation from her family all those years ago. My co-producer is Philippa Goodrich, and this is a CTVC production for the BBC World Service.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinnies. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
It's the early 1980s in El Salvador. And in the nightmare of civil war, civilians are caught between the government army and left-wing rebels.
I just remember they were saying, run, they're here. And I kept on running, and I found a spot where some people were hiding. And I asked if I could hide with them. And they said, no, there wasn't enough room to find somewhere else and to hurry because they were coming.
For this little girl, Flor de Luz, it seems there's nowhere to hide.
And I ended up seeing a little shack And I didn't know what else to do, so I kind of just ran in there and I ran behind the table, but you could still see me. And then eventually the door opened and there was a soldier there with a big rifle. And he didn't say anything, he just shot me. And the last thing I remember is him walking towards me and reaching for me before, like, I blacked out.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Mike Lanchin, and this is the second part of El Salvador's missing children. This is a quiet residential neighbourhood on the outskirts of the Salvadoran capital, and I'm on a side street with a large mango tree right at the very end. I'm here because at number 95, a small single-storey house with the paint peeling and an iron door, is where Flor de Luz, that little girl who was shot when hiding from the soldiers, came to live. It was the home of her foster parents. Flor remembers clearly arriving here. It would have been 1983 or 1984, and she'd have been 4 or 5 years old.
I wake up, and the first thing I did was I lifted up my shirt to see if, you know, the wound was still there. And I feel like some time has passed because it was already healed. I'm not really sure how long that was. But the next thing I realized that I was in a home, but I knew the home, and it turned out to be the foster parents' home that I was in.
Many of Flor's early memories are hazy. There are large bits missing, possibly blocked out by trauma. But as we talk on the line from her home in New York, it becomes clear that she retains vivid recollections of life with her foster parents. It wasn't a happy time. She remembers being made to work in the kitchen and the housekeeper regularly beating her. She also remembers secret visits from her birth mother and getting a gift from a woman whom she didn't know. No one ever explained to Flor why she wasn't with her own parents.
They never really told me anything. They were just kept on talking about how this woman wanted a picture of me and they wanted me to take a picture to give to her. She sent me a toy one time. It was a little bunny with jelly beans in it. And I didn't know if I should eat it. So I went to the street where all the street kids were, and I started giving it to them.
Do you remember when you first knew that you were going to be sent away to somewhere else, to another country?
I knew when I was on the plane.
Flor says there were other children on the plane, all apparently heading for adoption. When they got to the US, Flor's new family, a couple from Boston, were waiting at the airport.
I was scared because I didn't know who they were. My adopted mother, she didn't speak that well, but she's the one that explained to me that I was going with them, that they were waiting for me, and that she was the lady that was sending me things, the rabbit, and I had the rabbit with me. So she was like, that she sent me that. And so that's when I was like, okay, it's someone that knows me.
And so began her new life in the US. And though she was given a comfortable home, nice things, a good education, the trauma of what she'd left behind ran deep.
There was a time that my mother told me that when I was in kindergarten in the United States, she got a phone call to come to the school because there was an incident where I had all the children lined up in a firing squad. And I was standing in front of them, shooting all of them.
Mother and daughter, she says, struggled to bond.
I tried to get her to understand that I'm not who she wants me to be. And we're just very different. And I think that's what really bothered her, is because that she really wanted to have a little girl that she could make into her, you know? And I was not that.
Wait, you picked up a card and she gets to roll? I feel like you guys are telling me everything.
For a new direction.
It says she can roll. It says she
Those questions of who am I and where do I belong, they're common for many adopted children around the world. But for Flor, now in her 40s, joking and playing board games at home in New York with her own children, these are things that she still cannot resolve.
Okay, well, here.
It's complicated. Flor's American parents always told her that her birth parents had died in the Civil War in El Salvador and that she had no surviving family. And yet her adoption papers say that her mother gave up her rights over the child. And what about that scar on her stomach and running from the soldiers? Was that something to do with her adoption, she wondered. When Flor began looking for clues online, she was shocked by what she discovered about her country of birth.
I started finding out all these things, how the military was either going into little villages and taking the children, and they were either putting them in orphanages, they were either putting them up for adoption, or they were taking, I think, the males and making them into soldiers. And I said, oh my God, is that me? Have I been missing? Honestly, I just want to know what happened. Why I wasn't with my biological parents when I was running. Why was I separated? What happened from that moment?
Desperate for answers, Flor contacted the non-governmental organization in El Salvador, Asociación por Búsqueda, which has been helping reunite families split up by the war. Flor sent them her adoption papers and a DNA sample, and then waited for news. During the years reporting from El Salvador for the BBC after the end of the Civil War in 1992, I spoke to many families who'd been separated by the conflict. As the years went by, some were reunited. I still recall those emotional reunions. But I've always wondered how many adopted children from El Salvador are still out there, like Flor, wondering if anyone is looking for them. Father Manuel Acosta is a priest and until earlier this year was head of a government commission set up 5 years ago to help find children separated from families during the fighting.
These were families who had to flee because of the fighting and so handed over the children to others, or because the army had taken the children directly. There were very few cases of families giving up their children because of poverty. When the army carried out these operations, it is sort of respect the lives of the children. But still, the soldiers will take children and hand them on to powerful people, like lawyers, judges, military officers, who had illegal networks and trafficked them to foreign parents looking to adopt. Some were raised by good families, who brought them up with love. Others were taken out of the country.
Father Manuel says that the commission has located a number of children, but he said it doesn't have the powers to investigate any illegal networks or prosecute anyone involved.
Have you ever tried those, pupusas?
To test it.
So pupusa is a traditional food. It's made of maize with corn tortilla.
I would like to learn to make all of this.
I'm with Jasmine, who we met in the first episode and who, like Flor, was adopted from El Salvador as a very young child during the Civil War. She grew up with many of the same unanswered questions about her own adoption. We're at her home in southwest France, full of the usual clutter of children and pets, watching food videos on YouTube about the country she's never known, but which she feels a powerful connection with.
I would like to go with my husband to smell. I would like to hear, to see the life there.
Mm.
Like Flor, Jasmine is desperate for information that could help her find any surviving family she has in El Salvador and why her parents gave her up in adoption almost 40 years ago. She too has been in touch with Pro Búsqueda, the group in El Salvador that helps reunite families. She's already sent them her adoption papers and a DNA sample. Now, months later, she's just had an email back telling her that they've got important news. It's an emotional moment for Jasmine. She's asked me to join her on a Zoom call with the head of investigations at Pro Búsqueda, Margarita Zamora, and her colleague, Jonathan. I'm going to help with the translation.
Okay. De acuerdo a, a,
Jonathan begins by explaining that with Jasmine's adoption papers as a guide, they went to the village in the north of the country where the woman who's named as her mother, Antonia Mejia, was originally from. He says that they couldn't find Antonia. It appears that she had died several years earlier. But they did find a sister of hers. Could she be Jasmine's aunt, they wondered. It sounded promising, a potential breakthrough. But Jonathan says when they spoke to the aunt, their lead started to unravel.
They found the case confusing because the lady they spoke to said that Antonio Mejia had not given a child away in adoption.
Oh, that's strange.
I'm struggling to keep up with this twist in the story.
What they found was that Antonio Mejia had a child called Jasmine with the same surname as you, but that child is living in Guatemala and was never adopted.
Wow. Alors, je suis pas sûre d'avoir bien compris.
Jasmine's listening to all this, becoming increasingly distressed, trying to get it straight. She reverts to French, asking if she's understood correctly, that there's another child of Antonia Mejia, the woman she thought was her mother, and that this child has exactly the same name as hers, Jasmine Esmeralda, but that she was never given up in adoption and lives in neighbouring Guatemala. So there appear to be two women, both called Jasmine Esmeralda, with the same birth certificate. Margarita tries to explain. According to our investigations, she tells Jasmine, we think that the people who organised your adoption to France used the birth certificate belonging to someone else, to Jasmine, who lives in Guatemala. She says that they've come across similar cases where lawyers have presented false birth certificates for an adoption, often in collusion with local officials.
Pour moi, c'est des faux documents.
So my papers are false, Jasmine asks. Margarita is choosing her words carefully. Since someone else's birth certificate seems to have been used, we can say that the adoption process seems to have been fraudulent. Margarita says that Jasmine's French parents were most likely lied to as well.
Je savais qu'il y avait quelque chose qui allait pas.
I knew something wasn't right, she says. Her anguish and disappointment are so raw. First she was Aurélie, then she was Jasmine Esmeralda, and now she doesn't know who she is. Margarita and Jonathan also sound very upset. They hate breaking such sad news. But they've got as far as they can for now. They've double-checked with Jasmine's DNA test, and it doesn't match anyone in Antonia Mejia's family, so she couldn't even be a lost daughter. The Zoom call eventually comes to an end with Margarita assuring Jasmine that the investigation isn't over. They can only ask for her patience. I understand, Jasmine replies. I've waited 40 years already. I'll wait.
J'attendrai.
You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Mike Lanshin, and this is the second part of El Salvador's missing children. I've come back to El Salvador now, and here in the capital I've run into a sort of spontaneous street party in the very centre of the city. Passers-by are stopping to dance to one of several ragtag bands that are playing in the square here near the cathedral. Don't really remember coming across this before, but people do say that it's quite a common occurrence these days. I remember this square more for the scenes of jubilant crowds singing and dancing when the Civil War came to an end more than 30 years ago. Jasmine's story weighs heavily on my mind, and what I'm going to do now is try to track down someone who might be able to shed some light on this mystery.
I'm calling the real Jasmine in Guatemala now. I've got hold of a number for her. Remember, it was her birth certificate that was used to adopt Jasmine in France.
Hola, buenas tardes. ¿Qué tal?
So she's saying to me that she's really surprised to hear that there's another person in France using her birth certificate and with all the same details as her. Surprised, she says, and a little wary. So I'm asking her now what she thinks might have happened. I don't know, Jasmine says. So many bad things happen these days. It's very strange and a little frightening. I'm not sure she's got much more to add, so I think I'm going to thank her and hang up.
Gracias, Jasmine. Te paso buenas noches. Cuídese mucho. Adiós.
And then there's also the lawyer, or lawyers, who arranged the adoption to France. There were, in fact, two lawyers involved in Jasmine's adoption in 1984. One of them, I'm told, won't speak to me because he's too old and frail. The other lawyer, who's also in his 80s, tells me to come to his house across town. Well, it's now early evening and I'm back in the square near the cathedral. You can probably hear that there's an evening mass just about ending. I went to see the lawyer. He's an old man with a bushy grey moustache. And when I got there, he was wearing flip-flops and a baseball cap and sitting in a hammock. He said he hadn't been very well. Originally, he had agreed to be recorded, but later he said he'd changed his mind and didn't want me to use his name or his voice. Anyway, in summary, he told me that he had done dozens of foreign adoptions in the 1980s, mainly to France, and that all were above board, that they were relatively easy to do, he said. There were two French women who used to find the adoptive parents for him, and a midwife contact in the north of El Salvador, in one of the areas most affected by the war, who would bring him mothers who wanted to give up their babies, mainly poor peasants, he said, who couldn't afford children or already had too many. When I asked him about Jasmine's case, he said he had only vague memories. He did say he hadn't met the adoptive parents from France. He usually never did. And when I asked him how he thought that there could be two Jasmines with one birth certificate, he shrugged his shoulders. No puede ser. It can't be, he told me. No puede ser. How could that be? I asked the former member of the Government Commission on Missing Children, Father Acosta, what would help unravel this puzzle.
There has never been a national DNA database to search for the missing children. Neither left-wing nor right-wing governments have shown the political will. We have been calling for it for years.
And what does he think has been the effect on El Salvador and Salvadorian society of these unresolved cases from the past?
The continuous separation of families becomes a fracture in society. I think that if people don't have their own peace and peace for their families, then society as a whole cannot achieve peace, and conflict and divisions just continue.
Hello, Jasmine.
Yes, do you hear me?
I do.
Back in London, I called Jasmine in France.
How are you?
Quite well, quite well.
I tell her that I tracked down one of the lawyers who did her adoption, but that he said that he didn't really remember the details of her case.
When he said, I don't remember, do you think it's true?
That's a good question, Jasmine. I don't feel that he was trying to avoid my questions, and he seemed to be puzzled. He didn't seem to understand it at all.
I had been hoping to give Jasmine some answers, but at the end of our call, I feel I have to ask a difficult question.
Do you think there will be a moment when you'll have to accept that you may not find the truth out about who you are and where you come from?
Probably I will never know, but I will see.
Do you still feel hopeful?
Yes, I think. I hope, but I prefer wait
the good news and good informations, but not, I don't want to have pain. That's why I prefer to wait information if I have, it's good. If I don't have, never mind. It's like that.
You don't want to raise your expectations.
Voilà.
But there is a happy ending to one of the stories that we've been hearing of the missing children of El Salvador. You'll remember Flor from earlier, the little girl who was shot in the stomach and was later adopted by an American family, and who, like Jasmine, had loads of questions about where she came from, who she really was. Well, last year, Pro Búsqueda found four of Flor's living relatives in El Salvador, two half-brothers, a half-sister, and an uncle. They found them with the help of the adoption papers, which, unlike Jasmine's, proved to be genuine. DNA tests later confirmed it all. Flor then flew from New York to El Salvador for an emotional reunion.
Ta-da! Welcome, sister.
Thank you.
We love you.
Thank you so much. I don't know what to say.
Hugging, kissing and crying, Flor, her brothers Marlon and Alejandro, and sister Flor de Maria are meeting for the very first time.
I don't want to cry.
You can cry.
Flor has come straight from the international airport, about 3 hours' drive away. Her family has been waiting anxiously for her on the dusty, unmade road that leads into their little village. All the neighbours seem to have turned out. Someone sent me the video. I'd love to have been there. Flor looks overcome with joy, unable to take it all in. Alejandro, the youngest brother, struggles to express his emotions. It's a day our mother always dreamt of, he tells Flor. It's like a dream come true.
It's okay. It's okay. I'm here now, that's all that matters. Okay.
Marlon, the eldest of the three, hangs on to his newly found sister as if he's afraid that she might disappear again. The group makes its way, laughing and joking, up the road to the family home, a simple adobe house on the side of the hill. They all look so similar, broad shoulders, heavy build, tanned, although Flor is lighter skinned. Marlon stops for a moment. He wants to share his excitement and his story with Flor. Our mum always spoke about you, he says, and how beautiful you were. We spent years looking for you, but without success. And then one day, we got the news that you were looking for us.
Wow, yo me levanté del sofá y dije, what?
I'm keen to hear how it's been for Flor, finding all these relatives she never knew existed. And so a few days after the reunion, we speak on the phone. It's her last day in El Salvador.
Oh, my gosh, it's been great. It's been great. We've been joking around. I'm really goofy, so I was, like, trying to make sure, like, I didn't act crazy. But they're just like me. They're just, like, goofballs just like me. And they're very sweet and considerate about everything, making sure I'm comfortable in everything that I do. I was anxious all the way into the night before. I kind of had a little bit of a meltdown the night before because I was so nervous. What if they don't like me? What if we don't get along? What if the language is such a barrier that, you know, we can't really communicate? But that was not the case at all.
She says that she's been trying to piece together her story, those nagging questions that have been dogging her, like why was she given up for adoption? And what did the little scar from the bullet wound have to do with it all? She's spoken to her uncle, her mother's brother, who was in the Salvadoran army during the Civil War. He thinks that the soldier who shot her probably mistook her for the child of a guerrilla, and that maybe the army picked her up, wounded, and took her away. He says that perhaps it was someone in the military and not her mother who put her in the foster home and later up for adoption. I ask Flor, does this help her make sense of it all?
Oh, of course. Of course. I totally feel like this trip and getting these answers have totally made me like a whole now. I always felt like there were so many holes in my story, and now I don't feel like that anymore. I feel like I actually understand where everything came from.
And you, I remember you saying to me, you know, that at one point you thought, well, was I one of the missing children? Am I one of the missing children of El Salvador? I mean, what answer have you found?
The answer was yes, but not anymore. I'm not missing anymore.
Flor is now back in the US, overjoyed, I'm sure, that she has found some of the missing pieces to her life story. She told me she plans to go back to El Salvador soon with her children. And as for Jasmine in France, my heart goes out to her. She's been left waiting and wondering. Maybe she or the investigators in El Salvador will one day find some answers for her too. I do hope so, and that I'll get to see her reunion with her birth family. This has been El Salvador's Missing Children on the documentary with me, Mike Lanchin. My co-producer was Philippa Goodrich, and this is a CTVC production for the BBC World Service.
People fixing the world.
Brilliant solutions to the world's problems.
All right, let's do this.
We meet people with ideas to make the world a better place.
Trying new things that they're really passionate about.
And investigate whether they work.
The idea is you send in a robot where it's unsafe to send another human being.
Wow, okay.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Buckle up and get ready to ride.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.